The things didn't stir as she scurried towards them, bent almost double with the pyramid clasped tightly to her chest. But suddenly her feet were no longer running over the sand, and she was being lifted into the frigid air, and a thing with a face like a drowned rabbit turned slowly towards her and extended a talon. "You're not really here," Esk told herself. "It's only a sort of dream, what Granny calls an analogy. You can't really be hurt. It's all imagination. There's absolutely no harm can come to you. It's really inside your mind." I wonder if it knows that. The talon picked her out of the air, and the rabbit face split like a banana skin. There was no mouth, just a dark hole, as if the thing was itself an opening to an even worse dimension, a place by comparison with which freezing sand and moonless moonlight would be a jolly afternoon at the seaside. Esk held the disc pyramid and flailed with her free hand at the claw around her. It had no effect. The darkness loomed over her, a gateway to total oblivion. She kicked it as hard as she could, which was not, given the circumstances, very hard. But where her foot struck, there was an explosion of white sparks and a pop, which would have been a much more satisfying bang if the thin air here didn't suck the sound away. The thing screeched like a chainsaw, encountering deep inside an unsuspecting sapling a lurking and long-forgotten nail. The others around it set up a sympathetic buzzing. Esk kicked again, and the thing shrieked and dropped her to the sand. She was bright enough to roll, with the tiny world hugged protectively to her, because even in a dream a broken ankle can be painful. The thing lurched uncertainly above her. Esk's eyes narrowed. She put the world down very carefully, hit the thing very hard around the point where its shins would be, if there were shins under that cloak, and picked up the world again in one neat movement. The creature howled, bent double, and then toppled slowly, like a sackful of coat hangers. When it hit the ground, it collapsed into a mass of disjointed limbs. The head rolled away and rocked to a standstill. "Is that all?" thought Esk. "They can hardly walk, even. When you hit them, they just fall over." The nearest things chittered and tried to back away as she marched determinedly towards them. But since their bodies seemed to be held together more or less by wishful thinking, they weren't very good at it. She hit one, which had a face like a small family of squid, and it deflated into a pile of twitching bones and bits of fur and odd ends of tentacles, very much like a Greek meal. Another was slightly more successful and had begun to shamble uncertainly away before Esk caught it a crack on one of its five shins. It flailed desperately as it fell and brought down another two. By then the others had managed to lurch out of her way and stood watching from a distance. Esk took a few steps towards the nearest one. It tried to move away and fell over. They may have been ugly. They may have been evil. But when it came to poetry in motion, the things had all the grace and coordination of a deck chair. Esk glared at them and took a look at the disc in its glass pyramid. All the excitement didn't seem to have disturbed it a bit. She'd been able to get out, if this indeed was out, and if the disc could be said to be in, but how was one supposed to get back? Somebody laughed. It was the sort of laugh... Basically, it was Pchkdani Kwikov. This epiglottis throttling word is seldom used on the disc except by highly paid stunt linguists, and of course the tiny tribe of the Khatani, who invented it. It has no direct synonym, although the Kumhuli word, squirnt, the feeling upon finding that previous occupant of the privy has used all the paper, begins to approach it in general depth of feeling. The closest translation is as follows. The nasty little sound of a sword being unsheathed right behind one at just the point when one thought one had disposed of one's enemies. Although Katani speakers say that it does not convey the cold, sweating, heart-stopping, gut-freezing sense of the original. It was that kind of laugh. Esk turned around slowly. Simon drifted towards her across the sand, with his hands cupped in front of him. His eyes were tight shut.
"Did you really think it would be as easy as that?"
he said. Or something said. It didn't sound like Simon's voice, but like dozens of voices speaking at once. "Simon?" she said uncertainly.
"He is of no further use to us," said the thing with Simon's shape. "He has showed us the way, child. Now give us our property."
Esk backed away.
"I don't think it belongs to you," she said. "Whoever you are."
The face in front of her opened its eyes. There was nothing there but blackness. Not a colour, just holes into some other space.
"We could say that if you gave it to us. We would be merciful. We could say we would let you go from here in your own shape. But there wouldn't really be much point in saying that, would there?"
"I wouldn't believe you," said Esk.
"Well, then..."
The Simon thing grinned.
"You're only putting off the inevitable," it said.
"Suits me."
"We could take it anyway."
"Take it then. But I don't think you can. You can't take anything unless it's given to you. Can you?"
They circled round.
"You'll give it to us," said the Simon thing.
Some of the other things were approaching now, striding back across the desert with horrible, jerky movements.
"You'll get tired," it continued. "We could wait. We're very good at waiting."
It made a feint to the left, but Esk swung around to face it.
"That doesn't matter," she said. "I'm only dreaming this, and you can't get hurt in dreams."
The thing paused and looked at her with its empty eyes.
"Have you got a word in your world? I think it's called psychosomatic."
"Never heard of it," snapped Esk.
"It means you can get hurt in your dreams. And what is so interesting is that if you die in your dreams, you stay here. That would be nice."
Esk glanced sideways at the distant mountains, sprawled on the chilly horizon like melted mud pies. There were no trees, not even any rocks, just sand and cold stars, and... She felt the movement rather than heard it, and turned with the pyramid held between her hands like a club. It hit the Simon thing in mid-leap with a satisfying thump. But as soon as it hit the ground, it somersaulted forward and bounced upright with unpleasant ease. But it had heard her gasp and had seen the brief pain in her eyes. It paused.
"Ah, that hurt you, did it not? You don't like to see another one suffer, yes? Not this one, it seems."
It turned and beckoned, and two of the tall things lurched over to it and gripped it firmly by the arms. Its eyes changed, the darkness faded, and then Simon's own eyes looked out of his face. He stared up at the things on either side of him and struggled briefly, but one had several pairs of tentacles wrapped around his wrists, and the other was holding his arms in the world's largest lobster claw. Then he saw Esk, and his eyes fell to the little glass pyramid.
"Run away," he hissed. "Take it away from here. Don't let them get it."
He grimaced as the claw tightened on his arm.
"Is this a trick?" said Esk. "Who are you really?" "Don't you recognize me?" he said wretchedly. "What are you doing in my dream?" "If this is a dream, then I'd like to wake up, please," said Esk. "Listen, you must run away now, do you understand? Don't stand there with your mouth open."
"Give it to us,"
said a cold voice inside Esk's head. Esk looked down at the glass pyramid with its unconcerned little world and stared up at Simon, her mouth an O of puzzlement.
But what is it?
Look hard at it. Esk peered through the glass. If she squinted, it seemed that the little disk was granular, as if it was made up of millions of tiny specks. If she looked hard at the specks.
It's just numbers, she said. The whole world, it's all made up of numbers.
It's not the world, it's an idea of the world, said Simon. I created it for them. They can't get through to us, do you see? But ideas have got a shape here. Ideas are real.
Give it to us.
But ideas can't hurt anyone.
I turn things into numbers to understand them, but they just want to control, Simon said bitterly.
They burrowed into my numbers like...
He screamed.
Give it to us or we will take him to bits.
Esk looked up at the nearest nightmare face.
How do I know I can trust you? She said.
You can't trust us, but you have no choice.
Esk looked at the ring of faces that not even a necrophile could love. Faces put together from a fishmonger's midden, faces picked randomly from things that lurked in deep ocean holes and haunted caves, faces that were not human enough to gloat or leer, but had all the menace of a suspiciously V-shaped ripple near an incautious bather. She couldn't trust them, but she had no choice. Something else was happening, in a place as far away as the thickness of a shadow. The student wizards had run back to the great hall, where Q-Tangle and Granny Weatherwax were still locked in the magical equivalent of Indian arm wrestling. The flagstones under Granny were half melted and cracked, and the table behind Q-Tangle had taken root and already bore a rich crop of acorns. One of the students had earned several awards for bravery by daring to tug at Q-Tangle's cloak. And now they were crowded into the narrow room looking at the two bodies. Q-Tangle summoned doctors of the body and doctors of the mind, and the room buzzed with magic as they got to work. Granny tapped him on the shoulder.
A word in your ear, young man, she said.
Hardly young, madam, sighed Q-Tangle. Hardly young.
He felt drained. It had been decades since he'd dueled in magic, although it was common enough among students. He had a nasty feeling that Granny would have won eventually. Fighting her was like swatting a fly on your own nose. He couldn't think what had come over him to try it. Granny led him out into the passage and around the corner to a window seat. She sat down, leaning her broomstick against the wall. Rain drummed heavily on the roofs outside, and a few zigzags of lightning indicated a storm of ram-top proportions approaching the city.
That was quite an impressive display, she said. You nearly won once or twice there.
Oh, said Q-Tangle, brightening up. Do you really think so?
Granny nodded. Q-Tangle patted at various bits of his robe until he located a tarry bag of tobacco and a roll of paper. His hands shook as he fumbled a few shreds of second-hand pipeweed into a skinny homemade. He ran the wretched thing across his tongue and barely moistened it. Then a dim remembrance of propriety welled up in the back of his mind. He said.
Do you mind if I smoke?
Granny shrugged. Q-Tangle struck a match on the wall and tried desperately to navigate the flame and the cigarette into approximately the same position. Granny gently took the match from his trembling hand and lit it for him. Q-Tangle sucked on the tobacco, had a ritual cough, and settled back. The glowing end of the roll-up, the only light in the dim corridor.
They've gone wandering, said Granny at last.
I know, said Q-Tangle.
Your wizards won't be able to get them back.
I know that too.
They might get something back, though.
I wish you hadn't said that.
There was a pause while they contemplated what might come back. Inhabiting living bodies, acting almost like the original inhabitants.
It's probably my fault,
they said in unison, and stopped in astonishment.
You first, madam, said Cutangle.
Them cigarette-y things, asked Granny, are they good for the nerves?
Cutangle opened his mouth to point out, very courteously, that tobacco was a habit reserved for wizards, but thought better of it. He extended the tobacco pouch towards Granny. She told him about Esk's birth and the coming of the old wizard, and the staff, and Esk's forays into magic. By the time she had finished, she had succeeded in rolling a tight, thin cylinder that burned with a small blue flame and made her eyes water.
And I don't know that shaky nerves wouldn't be better, she wheezed.
Cutangle wasn't listening.
This is quite astonishing, he said. You say the child didn't suffer in any way?
Not that I noticed, said Granny. The staff seemed, well, on her side, if you know what I mean.
And where is the staff now?
She said she threw it in the river.
The old wizard and the elderly witch stared at each other, their faces illuminated by a flare of lightning outside. Cutangle shook his head.
The river's flooding, he said.
It's a million to one chance.
Granny smiled grimly. It was the sort of smile that wolves ran away from. Granny grasped her broomstick purposefully.
Million to one chances, she said. Crop up 9 times out of 10.
There are storms that are frankly theatrical, all sheet lightning and metallic thunder rolls. There are storms that are tropical and sultry, and inclined to hot winds and fireballs. But this was a storm of the Circle Sea Plains, and its main ambition was to hit the ground with as much rain as possible. It was the kind of storm that suggests that the whole sky has swallowed a diuretic. The thunder and lightning hung around in the background, supplying a sort of chorus, but the rain was the star of the show. It tap-danced across the land. The grounds of the university stretched right down to the river. By day, they were a neat formal pattern of gravel paths and hedges, but in the middle of a wet, wild night, the hedges seemed to have moved, and the paths had simply gone off somewhere to stay dry. A weak, weird light shone inefficiently among the dripping leaves, but most of the rain found its way through anyway.
Can you use one of them wizard fireballs?
Have a heart, madam.
Are you sure she would have come this way?
There's a sort of jetty thing down here somewhere, unless I'm lost.
There was the sound of a heavy body blundering wetly into a bush, and then a splash.
I've found the river, anyway.
Granny Weatherwax peered through the soaking darkness. She could hear a roaring, and could dimly make out the white crests of floodwater. There was also the distinctive river smell of the Ankh, which suggested that several armies had used it first as a urinal, and then as a sepulchre. Cutangle splashed dejectedly towards her.
This is foolishness, he said. Meaning no offence, madam, but it'll be out to sea on this flood, and I'll die of cold.
You can't get any wetter than you are now. Anyway, you walk wrong for rain.
I beg your pardon?
You go all hunched up. You fight it. That's not the way. You should, well, move between the drops.
And indeed Granny seemed to be merely damp.
I'll bear that in mind. Come on, madam. It's me for a roaring fire and a glass of something hot and wicked.
Granny sighed.
I don't know. Somehow I expected to see it sticking out of the mud or something. Not just all this water.
Cutangle patted her gently on the shoulder.
There may be something else we can do.
He began, and was interrupted by a zip of lightning and another roll of thunder.
I said, maybe there's something...
He began again.
What was that I saw?
Demanded Granny.
What was what?
Said Cutangle, bewildered.
Give me some light.
The wizard sighed wetly and extended a hand. A bolt of golden fire shot out across the foaming water and hissed into oblivion.
There!
Said Granny triumphantly.
It's just a boat, said Cutangle. The boys use them in the summer.
He waded after Granny's determined figure as fast as he could.
You can't be thinking of taking it out on a night like this, he said. It's madness.
Granny slithered along the wet planking of the jetty, which was already nearly under water.
You don't know anything about boats,
Cutangle protested.
I shall have to learn quickly, then, replied Granny calmly.
But I haven't been in a boat since I was a boy.
I wasn't actually asking you to come. Does the pointy bit go in front?
Cutangle moaned.
This is all very creditable, he said, but perhaps we can wait till morning.
A flash of lightning illuminated Granny's face.
Perhaps not,
Cutangle conceded. He lumbered along the jetty and pulled the little rowing boat towards him. Getting in was a matter of luck, but he managed it eventually, fumbling with the painter in the darkness. The boat swung out into the flood and was carried away spinning slowly. Granny clung to the seat as it rocked in the turbulent waters and looked expectantly at Cutangle through the murk.
Well,
she said.
Well, what?
Said Cutangle.
You said you knew all about boats.
No, I said you didn't.
Oh.
They hung on as the boat wallowed heavily, miraculously righting itself, and was carried backwards downstream.
When you said you hadn't been in a boat since you were a boy,
Granny began.
I was 2 years old, I think.
The boat caught on a whirlpool, spun around, and shot off across the floe.
I had you down as the sort of boy who was in and out of boats all day long.
I was born up the mountains. I get seasick on damp grass, if you must know,
said Cutangle. The boat banged heavily against a submerged tree trunk, and a wavelet lapped the prow.
I know a spell against drowning,
he added miserably.
I'm glad about that.
Only you have to say it while you're standing on dry land.
Take your boots off, Granny commanded.
What?
Take your boots off, man.
Cutangle shifted uneasily on his bench.
What have you in mind?
He said.
The water is supposed to be outside the boat. I know that much.
Granny pointed to the dark tide sloshing around the bilges.
Fill your boots with water and tip it over the side.
Cutangle nodded. He felt that the last couple of hours had somehow carried him along without him actually touching the sides, and for a moment he nursed the strangely consoling feeling that his life was totally beyond his control, and whatever happened, no one could blame him. Filling his boots with water while adrift on a flooded river at midnight, with what he could only describe as a woman, seemed about as logical as anything could be in the circumstances. A fine figure of a woman, said a neglected voice at the back of his mind. There was something about the way she used the tattered broomstick to scull the boat across the choppy water that troubled long-forgotten bits of Cutangle's subconscious. Not that he could be certain about the fine figure, of course. What with the rain and the wind and Granny's habit of wearing her entire wardrobe in one go, Cutangle cleared his throat uncertainly. Metaphorically a fine figure, he decided.
Look,
he said.
All this is very creditable, but consider the fact, I mean, the rate of drift and so forth, you see. It could be miles out of the ocean by now. It might never come to shore again. It might even go over the rimfall.
Granny, who had been staring out across the water, turned around.
Can't you think of anything else at all helpful that we could be doing?
She demanded. Cutangle bailed for a few moments.
No,
he said.
Have you ever heard of anyone coming back?
No.
Then it's worth a try, isn't it?
I never liked the ocean, said Cutangle. It ought to be paved over. There's dreadful things in it, down in the deep bits, ghastly sea monsters, or so they say.
Keep bailing, my lad, or you'll be able to see if they're right.
The storm rolled backwards and forwards overhead. It was lost here on the flat river plains. It belonged in the high ramtops where they knew how to appreciate a good storm. It grumbled around, looking for even a moderately high hill to throw a lightning at. The rain settled down to the gentle patter of rain that is quite capable of keeping it up for days.
A sea fog also rolled in to assist it.
Thank you.